Humankind is produced in association with WGBH Boston. This special project is supported by the Humankind Program Fund. Remembering the soul-stirring life of John Lewis, you're listening to a Humankind special. I'm David Freudberg. When I traveled to Washington to visit Congressman John Lewis at the Capitol in June 2007, I was well familiar with his extraordinary personal story. As a young leader of America's civil rights movement, he looked out on the huge throng that gathered at the Lincoln Memorial on a hot August day in 1963. That's when he addressed the March on Washington, joining Martin Luther King Jr. on stage. John Lewis was just 23 years old. He was a one-time chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, sealing his lifelong commitment to peaceful protest to secure human rights. His long journey included signing up for the Freedom Riders, who stood their ground trying to desegregate the American South and to secure voting rights for African Americans. They were arrested and beaten repeatedly. In 1965, John Lewis led a march from Selma to Montgomery across a bridge named for Edmund Pettus, a Grand Dragon of the Ku Klux Klan white supremacist organization. The event came to be known as Bloody Sunday when Alabama police attacked the protesters. John Lewis was savagely assaulted and nearly died. He was destined to become known as a civil rights icon. For 33 years, Mr. Lewis served in Congress, representing a district in Atlanta. In 2018, he gave the commencement address at Harvard University. Only cancer could stop John Lewis, left us at age 80 in July 2020. In planning our interview, which I treasure as one of the most remarkable meetings of my life, I decided not to ask him to recite the events on which he'd been interviewed probably thousands of times. My mission instead was a documentary about the role of ordinary citizens in our democracy. Excerpts of the interview are heard in our Humankind program, A Union of Citizens, available at humanmedia.org. Here now is my unedited conversation with John Lewis. When I arrived in town yesterday to prepare this documentary we're doing for public radio on the role of a citizen in a democracy, I went over to the Lincoln Memorial and read those famous words of President Lincoln from Gettysburg, where he described a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. What do you think is the essence of what he meant by a government of, by, and for the people?
I think President Lincoln was saying, in effect, that our government, this democracy, is a government that is controlled by its citizens, that it is not controlled by a president, a Congress, or a Supreme Court, but by the will and the power and the spirit of its people.
That's a radical idea. It certainly was in the 1700s when the founders of the United States conceived a system like this. Why do you think so many Americans feel that they're pushed out of the political process now, that the government is unresponsive to them?
There's a feeling in America today that the government and those of us at the highest level of government, whether it be the president or members of Congress, that we do not respond, that we are not listening to their cries, their moans, their plea, and they tend to drop out. They tend to give up. And there's a calling, there's a urgency that is growing in America today saying to the American people, don't drop out. Don't give up. Don't give in. But come back, return, get in the arena, and be involved. Do what I call get in the way. Another generation of Americans.
I'm sorry, get in the way?
Get in the way. Another generation of Americans got in the way. When I was growing up in rural Alabama during the 40s and the 50s, and we see those signs that said white men, colored women, white waiting. I saw segregation and racial discrimination. I would ask my mother, my father, my grandparents, my great-grandparents, why segregation? Why racial discrimination? And they would say, that's the way it is. Don't get in the way. Don't get in trouble. But I heard about Rosa Parks. I heard the voice of Martin Luther King Jr. on the old radio. And it inspired me to get in the way. And it's time for Americans of all faith, whether we be Democrats or Republicans or independents, to find a way to get in the way.
What are you calling on Americans to get in the way of?
I'm calling on Americans not to be silent, not to be complacent. When you see something that is not right, that is not fair, that is not just, when you see the country moving in the wrong direction, when you see your fellow humankind not being treated the way you think they should be treated, you have an obligation, you have a mandate, you have a mission to speak up, to speak out, to dissent, to protest, to go to the polls and vote. Too many Americans are not participating in the democratic process. They're not voting. And the vote is the most powerful nonviolent tool we have in a democracy. And we need to use it.
When people disengage, when they are cynical, what effect does that have on the functioning of our democratic system?
Oh, when people become cynical, when people are not engaged, when people drop out, it tends to say to elected officials, to people at the highest level of government, you know, it's okay. We can do what we want to do. And so many occasions, we have the tendency to do things in the name of the people without the people's approval.
So you mentioned a moment ago a lot of people think that the country is moving in the wrong direction. You see it moving in the wrong direction. What signs of that misdirection are you observing?
I see our country moving so far from its sense of mission, from its sense of purpose. And I think we have to ask the question, and it must be asked of all of us, what is our mission? What is our purpose? What is our role among the community of nation? What is our role and our obligation to our own citizen, to our fellow human beings? We spend hundreds, thousands, millions, and billions of dollars to engage in unbelievable military efforts abroad when we should be using our limited resources to build and not to kill, to provide health care for all of our people, to educate all of our children, to protect the environment, and to save this little planet we call Earth.
You mentioned a mission for our country, time to be thinking about that and defining it. Can you give me your vision of what our democracy would look like if Americans were more caring and more connected? Can you really take me there? I would love to hear how you see that.
I think it's the mission. It is the purpose. It is the goal. It is the longing it is, the hopes and dreams of our people today and our forefathers and our foremothers to build a sense of national community, but also to build and be part of the world community. But no one is left out or left behind. We're a blessed country. We are a blessed people. We have so many resources. Our founding fathers gave us the roadmap. They gave us the blueprint. And in my estimation, we're not using the roadmap and the blueprint to build a national community and a world community at peace with itself. We can use our efforts. We can use our resources not to be part of military efforts abroad, but be part of an effort or efforts to help heal, to help build. But no one have to suffer. We can do much more here at home and abroad. In spite of all of the changes, in spite of all of the progress that we've made as a nation and as a people, there's still too many people that are left out, left far behind.
What's blocking realization of that vision?
I think more than anything else in America, there's a need of leadership. Leadership at the highest level of government. Then we need in the Congress, we need in the White House, leaders that will stand up and say, this is where we're going to go as a nation and as a people. This is our calling. This is our mission. And not just be, oh, whatsoever come along, that we will go along. We lost something. We don't have the passion to fight for what we believe in as a nation and as a people. That's not this great sense of unity. And I've seen it in America. I saw it during the 60s. It was a calling to put an end to discrimination, to poverty, and to hunger.
People feel that if they take a step forward and try to make a difference, that it may fall on deaf ears, that it will be ineffectual, that the system will render them powerless, that there's no point in getting engaged. How do you respond?
Well, I believe there is this feeling that if we speak up, if we speak out, if we go in, vote, protest, those at the highest level of government would not respond, that they would not listen. But the struggle to create an American at peace with herself, or to create what we called during the 60s the beloved community, an all-inclusive community, it's not a struggle that lasts for 1 year, or a struggle that lasts for one presidential term. It's a struggle of a lifetime, and you must continue to struggle, continue to be engaged. You cannot give up. You cannot drop out. Every generation must continue to get out there and push and pull to build and continue to build.
Do you hear from people who feel disaffected, who feel disenfranchised, who feel that no matter what they do, it won't make a difference?
I hear from individuals from time to time, even some of my former colleagues during the movement have sort of dropped out. I said, it doesn't matter. We get registered, we vote. People are not listening. People are going to do what they want to do. And you have to tell people you cannot go down that road. You cannot give up. You cannot fall into a deep sea of despair. You have to be hopeful. And it's very much in keeping with our democracy. is very much in keeping with the democratic ideal. It's very much in keeping with the philosophy and the discipline of nonviolence, that you have to be hopeful. You have to be optimistic. Because if you give up, if you lose all sense of hope, it is like being dead. You have to be alive. You have to be engaged. You have to be out there in the stadium, in the arena, fighting. That's what it's all about. That's what life is all about.
Let's talk about the quality of public debate on issues that affect Americans. Look at healthcare. Poll after poll shows a strong majority of the country prefers government-guaranteed healthcare over the current system of employer-financed insurance. But that is not the policy of the country. People voted in November of 2006. The resounding message was, we need to change the course in the war. The war escalated, didn't de-escalate after that. How can greater citizen involvement improve the way we discuss issues of importance in America?
We must organize the unorganized from the bottom up, not from Washington down, at the locus level, whether it be in a village or hamlet. People must come to that point and say to the government, this is what we want, this is what we need, and this is what we're going to get. That is the government of the people. We have to say that. The people must say it. As Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. once said, the people must be able to say to their political leaders, you must say, as political leaders, yes, when you may have a desire to say no. Those at the highest level of government may say, we cannot do it or we will not do it. But the people must create the climate, the environment. Healthcare, in my estimation, is a basic human right. And the quality of a person's healthcare shouldn't be decided, as others have said, on the basis of a person's bank account or the size of a person's wallet. We all have a right to quality healthcare.
Since the public repeatedly has told pollsters this is what we want, why is this building, the U.S. Capitol, incapable of translating that into the law of the land? What blocks it?
In America today, in Washington today, there are so many competing interests saying we cannot do it. And said to members of Congress, said to the president, you cannot do it. But the people have the power, the people have the votes, and they have to do it. They have to continue to come over and over again. It is going to happen. It will happen. You know, in another generation, we said no to Social Security. We said no to civil rights. We changed that. We got Social Security. We got a Civil Rights Act in 64. We got a Voting Rights Act in 65. And we're going to get comprehensive health care for all of our citizens. It will happen. The people will make it happen.
Let's talk about the education of the people and the way in which they are informed about public issues so as to participate directly in interaction with members of Congress. One of the problems in our democracy is that many people have received misinformation and are not acting based on correct information. For example, more than two-thirds of the public in a Washington Post poll believed Saddam Hussein was personally involved in the September 11th terrorist attacks, which was disproven by the 9/11 Commission. President Bush acknowledged this was untrue, but the public believed it, and it created a climate in which that war was able to be launched with popular backing. What is the danger to our democracy when people are badly misinformed?
In a democracy such as ours, or any democracy, when people are misinformed, when people are misled, it creates very bad and dangerous decision. I think the case of the war is one of the most immoral acts of a Congress or a president in modern times.
The war in Iraq.
The war in Iraq. This war is tainted with the very soul of America. We've lost our moral standing in the world, and it would take generations to rebuild our standing as a moral leader. And it's all because of disinformation. People made terrible and bad decisions. And we don't have the capability, we don't have the capacity, we don't have the desire or the will to say we made a mistake. We made a blunder. Many blunders. And we need to move in a different direction.
But would those blunders have been harder to make were the people better informed and more actively informed?
If the American people had been better informed by the media and by the government leaders, we wouldn't be in the situation that we're in now. We'd be much better off. And for so long, some of our leaders kept saying to us, kept planning this idea that Iraq, that Hussein had some connection with 9/11. It was so misleading. It was so false. And I think it would probably go down as one of the saddest and lowest point in modern American history.
I remember in February 2003, about a month before the war was launched, I was covering a gigantic anti-war rally in New York City. I think there were 500,000 or 600,000 people who showed up. It was a bitterly cold day. And the information was pretty much clearly stated at that rally. I remember Desmond Tutu was there, Congressman Kucinich and others. The great skepticism was stated to a large throng of people. The information was circulating even before the war was launched. But people are simply not encouraged to take time in our society to ponder problems deeply, not by our media, not by our leaders. How can we promote a more deliberative approach and more critical thinking by American citizens?
Elected officials, members of the media, the academic community, civic, social, business groups, all must be part of an effort to help educate people about what is happening in America and around the world. People must be informed in order to make informed decisions.
But it seems that people are not deliberating deeply enough. We live in almost an attention deficit disorder society now. Things come and go so quickly. Everything is a flash in the pan. What can we do to deepen it, to allow people to think through their conscience, to ponder quietly, so that clearer voices are expressed by the people, making it harder for mistakes to be made by our government?
We live in a country where we're supposed to have freedom of the press and religious freedom. But I think to some degree, there's a sense of fear in America today that if you say the wrong thing, what some people would consider what is wrong, you step out of line, if you dissent, whether you be an entertainer, that somehow, in some way, this government or the forces to be will come down on you.
Look at what happened to the Dixie Chicks when they dissented against the
Iraq War. That's a very good example. People don't want to get in trouble. But I think there's a need for Americans to get in trouble, what I call good trouble, necessary trouble.
So you think that fear is a factor in inhibiting people from thinking deeply?
I think fear is a factor. Right after 9/11, you had people saying over and over again that you're siding with the terrorists. You're siding with the people that killed our fellow citizen. And even today, you hear people at high levels of government saying, we're doing this because we want to keep the battle over there rather than here.
Let's change gears a little bit here. Why do you think the voting rate of our poorest citizens is so low, that the people who are most disenfranchised by the process at the same time don't act to participate in the process to correct that imbalance? Why is that happening?
So many low-income and poor people have this feeling that my one vote will not count, that it will not make a difference. And I think after the last two national elections, it's the sense that, well, we won, but somehow we lost. So it created a greater degree of cynicism. More and more people drop out. When people go to the poll to attempt to vote in Florida or in Georgia or in Ohio or some other place, they are told that you cannot vote. Your name is not on the record. You're a felon. And you've never been arrested. You've never been in jail. So that creates a sense, why bother? And then this feeling that on the part of some low-income people, poor people, that I've been down so long until down don't get me down. They just give up. They drop out. And there is a need for a mighty, a powerful movement to set to low-income people, to poor people, to those with the least, that your one vote is just as powerful and as significant as the vote of the richest human being or the richest citizen of America.
As someone who sacrificed a lot during the height of the civil rights movement in the United States, for you, how precious is the right of an American to cast a ballot in an election?
For me, the right of a person, a citizen, to cast a ballot, to vote, is precious, almost sacred. Some of my friends, some of my colleagues, during the height of the movement, gave their very lives. I gave a little blood. And so it's, to me, it mean everything. And that's why some of us work very, very hard to make it possible for everybody to get out and be able to cast that vote. The vote is the most powerful nonviolent tool, nonviolent instrument that we have in a democracy, and we must use it.
Does it break your heart to recognize the low voter rates in our low-income populations?
It makes me very sad sometimes when I see the low turnout, the low participation on the part of us, large segment of our citizen. And I know we must do much more to try to get people or to get out and vote, to convince them to use the ballot. That's why I think it's important to have as many candidates out there running and appealing to people to create this interest, create this movement, that you will have a greater a turnout.
It seems like you need $100 million to run for president. Mitt Romney, our former Massachusetts governor, who happens to live not far from me, declared it would take $100 million for him to mount a credible campaign for the presidency. How could the average citizen possibly approach that level of money?
I think it's so sad that in our democracy, I'm not so sure this is what our founding fathers had in mind, that all these many years later, that it would take so much money to run for president. I think it's a shame and a disgrace that many of our elections have become like an auction. It's going to the highest bidder. We got to find a better way to make it possible for the average person to run for office, whether it be president, a governor, a mayor, a member of Congress.
Yesterday, I was interviewing John Bogle. He's the founder of Vanguard. He's also chairman of the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia, who just stepped down. I asked him about public financing of our election campaigns as a solution to this dilemma. He worried that there would be free speech conflicts that could be posed by that. Where do you come down on that point?
Well, I believe in this idea of public financing of campaign.
Exclusive public money?
I think somehow, in some way, you have to make available not just public financing, but you got to make the airways available to candidates.
Compel stations that are licensed by the public, by the Federal Communications Commission, to avail candidates of free airtime?
I believe that's the way we have to go. So much of the resources,
many
of the dollars are spent on media, television, radio, newspaper ads. We got to take some of the money out of election.
Would the broadcast lobby tolerate that?
Oh, I think the broadcast lobby will stand up and fight against that. But somehow, in some way, we got to make the fight. We got to make the effort. It's obscene, the amount of money that people have to raise. I see members of Congress, especially young members, come, and they spend all their time dialing for dollars.
So explain this mystery to me. I can't imagine anyone more than a member of Congress who would recognize the tremendous drain, the tremendous waste of time and energy spent in fundraising that diverts them from the business of legislating. Why does the Congress have the inability to say, we're going to put this forward, we're going to put public financing through, we're going to legislate it, and we're going to submit that to the president? Why can't the Congress, of all people in the country, act with that boldness?
I think there's a need in the Congress, on our part, for bold and aggressive leadership. But also there is a need for the media, for people in the academic community, the religious community, and for the President of the United States to get out front and say, this is what we're going to do, and get the citizenry behind it. We got to take some of the money out of the election. It's too much.
We just have a couple minutes left. Can you connect for us the proposition that all people are created equal with the role of average citizens in our democracy? Are those two ideas linked for you?
Oh, I truly believe that all citizens, all human beings, are created equal. That we all should be on the same footing, that we all come to the table together. And there should be a place at the table of our democracy for all of us. It doesn't matter whether we're black or white, whether we are Hispanic or Asian American or Native American. It doesn't matter whether we're gay or straight, whether we are Protestant, Catholic, Jewish, or Muslim, or some other faith. We shouldn't draw lines and say in a democracy, you cannot do this, you cannot go there because of your faith or because of your party affiliation or because of your gender or sexual orientation. When we speak of equality, it's equality in the radical sense. It's complete, it is whole. And we should not discriminate against any of our citizens.
And is that equality the basis for citizenship?
Equality is citizenship. You cannot separate. Whether someone is born in America or whether someone come into America and become a citizen, you're equal under the law. You cannot change that. You cannot deviate from that. It is one of those immutable principles. And whatever we try to do as a nation and as a people, if we try to tamper with that, they will tamper with the very foundation of our democracy.
Are they tampering with it?
Oh, I think there's an attempt from time to time to say because of your race, your color, your sexual orientation, because you're not speaking English, because you don't have a certain amount of money. I think that's an attempt to tamper with that idea.
I guess my last question, we have a trend of growing income inequality in the United States. What does that do to the fabric of our democratic society to have such high concentrations of wealth at one end and a large and growing number of people who are not insured for health, who have unequal educational opportunities, unequal job opportunities? What does that do to our democracy?
To have in America, to have in our democracy, such unbelievable disparity is a threat to our sense of peace. To our sense of order. To our sense of equality. If you have and continue to have this disparity when it comes to income, health, education, I think in years to come, it spell real trouble for America.
Do you foresee that it could lead to unrest?
It is my feeling that if we do not do something and do it in a hurry to close the gap between the haves and the have-not, we will be creating a situation that can bring down the curtains on the American dream. I think it is important, it is a must, for citizens to be involved, to be engaged. That is part of the price that we pay for being part of a democracy.
Thank you very much for your time, sir.
Thank you, sir.
A conversation with Congressman and civil rights icon John Lewis, recorded at the Capitol in June 2007. He died in July 2020. I'm David Freudberg.